Welcome to the podcast service of the Massachusetts Climate Action Network. Visit us online at massclimateaction.net or friend us on Facebook.
Hi, and welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for insight and perspective on global warming news. My name is Ted McIntyre, and this show is for the week of September 23rd, 2016. Today we're joined by our frequent guest, the prolific commentator, Mr. D.R. Tucker. How are you doing, D.R.?
Good. How are you doing?
Very well, very well. Glad you could be here. So, D.R., this was, as many weeks are, an interesting week in climate change action, doing things. One of the important things that happened this week is that Governor Baker, the governor of Massachusetts, issued an executive order. Did you hear anything about that?
Yes, it was an extensive executive order basically requiring that his entire administration take some bold action to comply with the tenets of the 2008 Global Warming Solutions Act. The State House News Service stated that the executive order is, quote, directs to examine emission limits for a range of sectors and outline a timeline for regulations to ensure the state meets carbon reduction targets, and also commits the administration to work on additional steps to, quote, develop regional policies to reduce transportation sector emissions, unquote, which suggests, among other things, that there'll be some encouragement for more electric vehicles on the roads in the Commonwealth.
Interesting. Yes, yes, I agree. I went so far as to pull down the actual text of the executive order, and since it reads so marvelously, I thought that I think it's useful to read it because one of the things the executive order does, and I guess it's a format for all of these kind of executive orders, but it sort of lays out these a given, right? Mm-hmm. They say whereas blah 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 blah, and whereas blah 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 blah. These are the basic reasons for the governor's action, and so what I was going to do is step through at least an abbreviated version of those so people can hear what the governor was thinking when he wrote this order. So let me go ahead. There's probably 10 or 12 of them. So let me just, I'll put on my best town crier. You ever had that image of the guy with the three-cornered hat ringing the bell and reading the Declaration of Independence? Well, here we go. Anyway, the governor's order says this: whereas climate change presents a serious threat to the environment and the Commonwealth's residents, communities, and economy, and whereas extreme weather events associated with climate change present a serious threat to public safety, and whereas the Global Warming Solutions Act directs the Secretary of Energy and Environmental Affairs to take certain steps, and whereas the statewide greenhouse gas emissions have been set for 2020, but no interim limits have been set for 2030 or 2040, and whereas the Commonwealth can provide leadership by reducing its own emissions, and whereas the transportation sector continues to be a significant contributor, and whereas the generation and consumption of energy continues to be a significant contributor, and whereas the Supreme Judicial Court said that the steps mandated by the Global Warming Solutions Act include promulgations of these regulations, and whereas the ambitious goals for the greenhouse gas emissions will help mitigate future climate change, and whereas our state agencies, as well as our cities and towns, must prepare for the impacts, and whereas the Executive Office of Public Safety has deep institutional expertise, and finally, whereas through an integrated strategy bringing together all parts of state and local government, will we be able to address these threats effectively. So I guess those are the whereas. That's why the governor took action. And I think it makes a good case, and it makes a case that a climate hawk would make, right? Mm-hmm. And I guess, you know, Governor Baker has not been a strong climate hawk heretofore, has he, right? A few years ago, he was kind of wishy-washy.
Exactly. It's interesting to see the reversal, even though, as we noted before, it's sort of a court-required reversal. And a lot of the coverage of Baker's executive order has noted that, you know, he is now with this executive order and with his call for strengthening the regional greenhouse gas initiative, he's essentially now continuing in the footsteps of the former governor Deval Patrick, which is interesting because now, as you may know, the new pejorative term on the part of, you know, Baker's erstwhile supporters who are now disappointed in his actions, they're now running around calling him Tall Deval. Well, if that is meant to be an insult, I think that Baker should take it as a compliment, because if he does continue what Patrick did on this issue, that's going to make him go down as a pretty accomplished governor.
Yeah, no, I think it is. It's very interesting. I mean, the very first statement in this executive order is that climate change presents a serious threat to the environment and the Commonwealth's residents. I mean, that's just on the face of it means you can't, you can no longer deny climate change, right? The governor said this is for real. And I think that the last of these statements is also an interesting one from my perspective. We can talk about it a little bit more because there's some detail underneath this. But the last whereas is that, whereas only through an integrated strategy bringing together all parts of state and local government. I mean, the integrated strategy part was what was missing from the Global Warming Solutions Act implementation to date, right? It was kind of every man for himself, and each agency was supposed to do something, but there was no integration. And one of the things that the governor has ordered is that every state agency volunteer someone for a committee that has to, and has responsibility to the Secretariat's climate change coordinator. Right, so there's going to be this central committee, which is central committee is a bad word to say. There's going to be a joint committee that will follow this stuff. So it's good.
It's going to be very interesting to see how he lays out in his January 2017 State of the State address how he plans to implement this executive order and what steps he's going to specifically take to make sure that the terms and conditions of the executive order become a real thing.
Well, I think that is true. I mean, executive orders have only the force with which they are prosecuted, right? I mean, it's only if we go after it and say that, yes, this is a real thing, we're going to make it happen. And in fact, I think one of the things that the governor has ordered is that there will be a internet portal for people to make comments, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so that's another good thing in this. But so I was speaking with someone who I won't mention his name, leaving him anonymous. But he was thinking about this, saying that the most important part of this executive order is that the governor has committed to making setting the aggressive greenhouse gas reduction limits for 2030. Those targets. Mm-hmm. By the end of 2020, so that he that he will set the 2040 targets before the end of 2030. And that's important because the two numbers that the Global Warming Solutions Act contained, which is, of course, was sort of the context of this executive order, the two numbers that are in there are a 20% reduction by the year 2020 and then an 80% reduction by the year 2050. Mm-hmm. But the pathway at 2030 and 2040 is left open. Right? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, you could be within the law and say, well, we're going to plan to reduce carbon emissions by 80% in the year 2049 and make the goal of 2050. Right? Mm-hmm. It would never happen, but you could do that. Right? Whereas setting these interim goals at the year 2030 and the year 2040 is a very good strategy.
It is a good strategy, although you have seen this question being discussed, and it is something that one wonder how this executive order and the statements in the executive order, how that squares with the longstanding advocacy for more natural gas infrastructure in Massachusetts. Obviously, these are two contradictory ideas.
Yeah, I mean, and I think that comes back to the question of you know, how much oomph is the governor going to put on it. But I think that there's somewhere in here that he talks about you know, statewide sort of infrastructure to make sure we reach these goals. I mean, the real question is this a change, you know, more than a political statement on the part of the governor? And has he really made a commitment to something here? We hope. You got to give the guy kudos for this kind of executive order. The question is, will we follow through on it? I mean, the executive order did come out at 4:59 on Friday afternoon last week, right? Mm-hmm. Guaranteed to be in the black hole of news coverage where no one would notice it. But still in all, it's a good thing. I mean, I think one of the other important, so besides the two goals for 2030 and 2040, right? So there's a lot around here, but there are overall targets for carbon emission reductions at 2020 and 2050 that are in the law, and the governor's going to set them at 2030 and 2040 so that we have a nice glide path. But the other thing that came up here was the idea that transportation is one of the leading greenhouse gas emission sources in the state. And how do you control emissions from automobiles, right? That's a So what do you think the governor can do in that sense?
Well, that goes to an issue that came up in a piece, I believe it was written by David Cash in Commonwealth Magazine, discussing, you know, the further things that can be done to sort of really, you know, reduce emissions in Massachusetts. And he suggested that two things could be done: either expand REGI beyond its current limitations to more sections to make it truly an economy-wide price on carbon, or start pushing for a state-level carbon tax or carbon fee similar to what exists in British Columbia. Mm-hmm. It'll be interesting to see if Baker embraces either idea. Obviously, he talked about strengthening REGI overall, but will he embrace the idea of strengthening REGI's or expanding REGI's requirements in Massachusetts? As you may or may not know, there's also a push not only to have a state-level carbon tax, but also for Massachusetts to join California in calling on Congress to pass a carbon tax as well. So it'll be very, very interesting to see how Baker deals with these two ideas that were raised by Mr. Cash in that great piece in Commonwealth Magazine.
Yeah, and just to keep everybody on the same page, the REGI, the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, RGGI, is a cap-and-trade system for permission to pollute, to permission to make carbon emissions from electrical power plants, right? Mm-hmm. So it's all works within only the electrical generation regime, and there's a sort of a fixed number of plants that make electricity, and, you know, so there's a fixed number of players. I mean, what you were just saying, DR, is that this, the idea is that somehow the cap and trade mechanisms that are held in REGI, which are now applied only to electrical power plants, be expanded to apply also to, I guess would have to be gasoline at the gas station, right? Or there would be some sort of thing there?
David Cash says that, quote, it could be an expansion of REGI beyond just the electricity sector to include heating, transportation, industrial, and commercial energy use.
So, but I mean, I guess, so it's just interesting. It's not clear to me how that could, I mean, it's easier for me to see how a carbon tax would work, right? Because then the carbon tax is a number on the pump when you go to buy gasoline, right? And that deters you. Whereas the trading emissions from the automobile, because the automobile sector, the transportation sector is so diffuse, right? Literally. I mean, there's millions of cars. So how do you regulate all those?
But we should also note that the only way something like that gets implemented in this state is if the citizens demand it. The old line I keep saying about power concedes nothing without a demand. We are both aware of that piece that ran in the Boston Globe a couple of days ago about the powerful industry lobby, I believe it's called AIM, Associated Industries of Massachusetts, which is vehemently against carbon pricing and exhorts an undue level of influence in the Commonwealth, and only citizen activism can overcome that influence.
Yeah, and I agree. So we have this executive order. Good on the governor. We think he's done a good thing. It's the potential to be a great thing if it is played out and citizen activism makes sure that everything in it is played out. But the David Cash article in Commonwealth Magazine that you mentioned, DR, I think was a very interesting one, because Cash in that article, and we'll put a link to it, was making the case that within the last year, a whole bunch of big governmental systems in Massachusetts have aligned themselves with a clean energy future. That is to say, the Supreme Judicial Court made two very important rulings. They said that the Global Warming Solutions Act actually requires regulation and mandated reductions in emissions, right? That's a big deal. That's the basis for this crazy executive order. But at the same time, the Supreme Judicial Court also said that the Supreme Judicial Court said that the pipeline, we couldn't have the tariff on the pipeline tax. So there's two big things from the Supreme Judicial Court. The legislature passed the Omnibus Energy Bill, right, which calls for the use of clean hydropower and for building lots and lots of wind turbines. Mm-hmm. And then Governor Baker comes out and says he wants to have the regional greenhouse gas initiative cap be reduced by an aggressive 5% per year. We talked about that a couple of shows ago. And now we've got this executive order where he's aligning the whole Massachusetts state government behind climate change action. And so Cash's argument is saying that even though they may not have thought about it, Massachusetts state government, probably because of citizen activism, right, climate hawks pushing for it, all of a sudden the ship is starting to turn and aim at a really viable future because all three branches of government have said we got to go in this direction. Did you see that? I mean, what do you think?
Well, the ship is starting to turn, and we know it's not going to hit an iceberg because the iceberg's melting. But in any event, you know, obviously it's going to require more citizen activism because you mentioned that legislative effort and how we've discussed before how watered down that legislative effort was, nowhere near as aggressive as it needed to be and as it could have been. Mm-hmm. And that just basically goes to show you that if Massachusetts can do so much more on this if the citizens demand it, but they have to demand it.
Yes, I agree. I mean, this is but it's a hopeful thing. I mean, I think that anyone listening to the show, if you're in Massachusetts, you should be proud. If you don't live in Massachusetts, I hope that this is an example to other states because, I mean, this stuff is possible through consistent tiny efforts and it's a hopeful sign. For the future, right? All this stuff coming together. So, DR, before we leave, we'll have to quit in a minute, but you said that there was a movie you were planning on seeing or that people ought to know about. What's going on there?
Yeah, there's a screening of a movie, of a short documentary called Facing the Surge, which is discussing the so-called sunny day flooding in Norfolk, Virginia, and how it's affecting, you know, the livelihood of residents in that city and how they're planning to do something about it. It's scheduled to be screened.
And just before you give the date, the sunny day flooding is the subject of that New York Times article a couple of weeks ago where basically the high tides now flood places that it didn't used to flood, right?
Exactly. Okay. Exactly.
So where is it going to be and when?
There are two screenings on September the 23rd, one scheduled for noon at Salem State College and one scheduled for 7 p.m. at First Parish Church in Duxbury. So and there'll be links provided for people who want to check those documentaries out, and there'll be a lot of conversation afterwards regarding what to do about this issue and the sort of citizen activism that can be engaged in among concerned activists,
climate hawks,
address this issue.
Super, super, super. So we'll put up links to that in the blog that is associated with this podcast, which leads me to say things like, well, yes, the blog is on the massclimateaction.net website, which is massclimateaction.net/blog. So please go there to check out the links. You can find a link to the blog on our Facebook page at /massclimateaction. Please share us, like the page, share us so other friends can find out about the show. You can listen to the show directly on your smartphone using Stitcher or TuneIn Radio. And, of course, you can find us on iTunes. All you have to do is search for Massachusetts Climate Action. So, DR, we're going to close the way we always close by saying that because we recognize the necessity of personal accountability for our actions, because we accept responsibility for building a durable future, because we believe it's our patriotic duty as citizens to speak out, we must insist that the United States, and maybe even the state of Massachusetts, put a price on carbon. Thanks, DR, for being here.
Thanks.
Thanks to everyone for listening. It's been a pleasure having you along. We'll talk to you again soon. Bye-bye.
Thanks for being with us. And until next time, be green.
Very cool.